Hello, my name's Craig Barker, and I'm the head of public engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters. Object Matters is a podcast that explores the relationship between our guest and a museum collection item or series of items. For this particular episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by my colleague, Kelsey McMorrow. Kelsey is the curatorial assistant with the science collections at the Chow Chak Wing Museum. Welcome, Kelsey. Thank you for joining us on Object Matters.
Thank you for having me.
I'm looking forward to this. I've been trying to get you on for some time. Could I begin by asking you about your role at the museum? What does your job involve?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm the curatorial assistant of science. So basically that means that I assist with curating and managing the museum's science collections. So I work most closely with the scientific instrument collection, and my job involves things like researching objects, something we call cataloguing, which, as you know, involves compiling key information about objects for our records. I also assist with the acquisition of objects, and I'm involved in things like interpreting and sharing knowledge about the collections with the public.
Okay, great. Could you tell us more about your background and research interests? How did you come to work at the Chow Chak Wing Museum? I'm assuming you've got a background in science.
So I've always been interested in history and the ways in which people understand themselves and also the world around them. So as an undergraduate, I studied history and psychology. And then it was really, I guess, my interest in sharing stories, particularly with the public, as a way for people to learn and connect with each other, that really inspired me to undertake my Master of Museum and Heritage Studies here. And then it was while I was studying that course that I actually started volunteering at the Nicholson and the Maclay Museums. And then I was lucky enough to land a casual role where I was transcribing historic labels in the entomology or the insect collections. And then I started cataloguing microscopes, and eventually I worked my way up to the role that I'm in now.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you actually start with your current role?
So my current role has kind of been ongoing for a few years now, but the role that I'm specifically in now as the curatorial assistant was back in 2018. Now I want to double check that.
I mean, anything before COVID is such a blur anyway.
It's really a blur.
Now, you are responsible in this role for looking after the science collections, as you mentioned. Could you talk about the nature of the science collections? What do we have in the holdings? Mm.
So the collection itself started about 50 years ago with an exhibition held at the Maclay Museum called Historical and Interesting Scientific Instruments.
What a great name for an exhibition.
I know, it's dry, isn't it? So this featured objects that were once used at the university. And from there, once the exhibition wound up, many of the objects were then transferred to the museum, and that's what formed the basis of the scientific instrument collection. So today we have more than 3,000 objects in the collection from a range of science disciplines, so everything from physics, chemistry, engineering, biology, and so on.
Yep, geology.
Yeah, and the collection still has a key focus on objects that are used in science teaching and research here at the university.
Yep.
And I think this is important because the university is the oldest in Australia, and it's been teaching science since its doors first opened to students in 1852. So because it reflects this long history, many future scientists have been trained at the university over the years. It also reflects Australian science and the history of Australian science as a whole.
Yeah, and I imagine it reflects both commercially available instruments that were being used by researchers and teachers, but also perhaps things that have been homemade, shall we say?
Absolutely. So we have a range of instruments, everything from the key most important instrument makers and manufacturers over the years to things that were made in-house. And by in-house, we mean in various departments at the university, as well as things, like you said, that are genuinely homemade by researchers and teachers at the university over the years as well. It's quite a diverse collection in that sense.
I imagine they must be a nightmare at times because obviously with commercially available ones, there's at least some degree of historical records of sale catalogues and records of other purchases. But if it's actually literally a professor who has devised something themselves, that must be quite tricky at times trying to figure out when it was made and what it was being made for.
For sure. In a lot of cases we've been very lucky that people will also pass on their archives and their records as well.
Yep.
And from those and their own documentation, we're able to piece together more information.
Yeah.
those cases make it much, much more easy, but not every case is like that.
Well, it's great you talk about it, how it reflects the history of teaching science in Australia, but it's also, I guess, in some degree, a collection that's the history of the commercialization of science as well, too, that as universities and schools are expanding in the late 19th century, the need for consistent instruments for measuring the research and the teaching, it must nicely reflect that sort of growing confidence of science.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you see lots of technological changes and developments just by comparing more modern instruments with more historic ones over time. But I think that really harks back to the use of the collections, I suppose. So scientific instruments can teach us lots of different things, like you're suggesting. So they help us understand the practice of science itself. All the instruments have been used at one stage by someone who's trying to find something out or teach someone something.
Yeah.
But they also document the connections that these objects have to many different things. So we can see, you know, just by looking at one object, how it's had influences in lots of different spheres. So one object travels to the collection. One object can be have many uses over its lifetime. So it might be used by teachers and students, or it might be used by scientists themselves, or all of those things in one lifetime.
It's a really interesting perspective, isn't it, from a curatorial and collection-keeping perspective, the idea of, you know, not just an instrument or not just an object, but an object that was often, you know, duplicated, 50 Bunsen burners being used for first year chemistry classes in the 1920s. And obviously we don't need to collect all 50 of them, but having one as a, or one or two as a representation of that important role in education must be really, really exciting.
Yeah, no, it's really exciting to have those representative examples. But I think what's really interesting is even though an object might be represented several times, we have several cases of it, for example, or something ubiquitous like a Bunsen burner, sometimes those objects have a connection to a specific person or a specific event, and then that broadens its history and the stories we can tell with it as well.
So, Object Matters is a podcast about objects. What objects, because I believe you've chosen two, what objects have you chosen from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection for us to discuss today?
So I've chosen two gas discharge X-ray tubes.
Okay.
So these are...
You know what my first question is going to be.
So in simple terms, these are devices used for generating X-rays.
Yeah.
So they both essentially look like something from maybe an early or a classic science fiction movie.
Yes,
right?
Yes. They do have that very sort of mad scientist
feel,
don't they?
So each tube consists of, imagine a large glass sphere, slightly tinged purple, and it has three arms protruding out from it, two short arms and one long. And they both have some metal components attached to them as well.
Yeah.
So the two shorter arms are connected by a coiled wire, and then inside of each of the arms is an electrode, which looks like a thin metal bar, usually with a plate on the end.
Yeah.
And then one of the X-ray tubes also has an extra L-shaped appendage coming out from the top, and that's called a regulator.
Okay. So before we talk about them in more detail, why did you choose this pair? Why is it of interest for you when you know, you've got more than 3,000 across the collection? What stood out about them?
So I guess the key thing that stood out about them is what I've kind of been talking about. It's the stories behind them.
Yep.
So these are both early examples of X-ray tubes. They were probably both made in the early 1900s, which isn't long after a man called Wilhelm Röntgen discovered X-rays in 1895. And I'm just going to give you a little background about that because it will help us understand these two tubes. So he discovers X-rays while experimenting with something called a cathode ray tube. He covers it in heavy black paper, but he's surprised to see that a fluorescent screen nearby still lights up, even though he's covered it with this thick paper. So he starts experimenting, and he finds that this mysterious light can pass through many substances, but it leaves shadows of solid objects on film. So then he starts experimenting with human tissue, and he sees that he can still see the bones on film. So then, of course, this announcement of this discovery generates a whole lot of excitement throughout the medical world and the scientific world as well.
Yeah.
And the applications for medicine straight away become clear.
Yep.
So x-rays can be used to diagnose a broken bone, locate a bullet or a swallowed object, all without having to cut a person open. So then, following Röntgen's discovery, people start to produce tubes like the ones that I've chosen today,
yep,
which are specially designed for producing x-rays. And in those early years, we start to see some technological developments to improve their performance. And these show some of those, which I'll get into a little bit later.
Yep.
But I think the main reason that these were of interest to me is actually because of the markings that are on them. So one of the tubes is inscribed Cox's Record, and then the other one has a label which says Cox's X-ray Tube and the address of a manufacturer called, yep, Harry W. Cox.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about Harry W. Cox in a moment,
because, yep,
there's obviously a bit of a tale here. But, you know, in terms of this early development of the X-ray, and I mean, it's interesting you talk about obviously its medical implications, but it's been picked up from a range of industries very quickly.
For sure.
I know in my own field of archaeology, of course, the X-raying of mummified human remains from Egypt, mm-hmm, is done very, very early on. Bit of dispute as to who, but it's often claimed a graduate from the University of Sydney, Grafton Elliott Smith, who is also featured in the collection. Mm. So there's kind of interesting how it all fits together. But were the early pioneers of X-raying, including the manufacturers of these, aware of the danger?
No. And that's actually part of the story that I'm going to get into today. So the man who manufactured these was one of those early pioneers who wasn't aware of these dangers.
Right.
And that sadly had some horrible consequences.
All right. Well, who was Harry Cox?
So Cox, like we said, was a pioneer in the manufacture of X-ray apparatus. So he was born in England around 1863. He trains as an electrician. He's one of these people who hears about Röntgen's discovery in 1895 and is immediately intrigued.
Mm.
So he quickly starts researching, experimenting with the rays, and very quickly he decides to actually make X-rays his livelihood.
Yeah.
So he decides it's going to be his personal goal to perfect X-ray apparatus.
Oh, right. And was he thinking in terms of commercial or more altruistic thinking?
Kind of both, yeah. I think. So he was really interested in making it work as efficiently as possible.
Yep.
But he ends up securing a number of patents for different X-ray apparatus. And
right,
one of those was actually for locating bullets in terms of the depth and the location of them.
Yeah.
So he does have altruistic sort of intentions as well. Yeah.
Mm.
So he starts a business bearing his own name, Harry W. Cox, and starts importing tubes from Germany initially. Then he begins designing and manufacturing X-ray devices, and in doing so, he becomes actually one of the first British manufacturers of these devices.
Right, so it's really early days.
Really, really early days. By 1898, he's already grown his company enough to move to a larger premises, and he actually becomes a limited company at that time as well.
Right, okay.
So he starts demonstrating his wares at optical, photography and chemistry trade fairs, where he uses the tubes to show spectators their bones on a screen. So imagine the dangers of that, I'm sure. Soon his tubes are being purchased all around the world. We find them in hospitals in London,
yeah,
and all across the globe. He's even asked to demonstrate his X-ray apparatus on stage at the Shakespeare Theatre.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, during a play which heavily featured radiography, and they really wanted it to look accurate.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, that Victorian fascination with progress at the same time as the circus fair.
Absolutely.
We're all aware of in so many different forms.
Yeah.
But that's really extraordinary to have that sort of performative aspect of scientific development.
I think that's part of what's going on here.
Yeah.
So we've got that interest in sideshows, and part of that is, I think, driving the interest in his work,
particularly at these
trade fairs,
yeah,
getting him into the plays, for example, as well.
I just find it interesting. You're selling to hospitals during day and then demonstrating to circus attenders in the evening.
Anyone and everyone. So he even installs an X-ray outfit on the royal yacht, the Victoria in Albert.
Yeah.
And he gives a demonstration to the future King Edward,
yeah,
and as well as the then Princess of Wales and other members of the royal party who were super interested in X-rays.
So were they getting were the royal hands being X-rayed at the time? Or?
He was showing his own foot, apparently. Oh, okay. But there's a story that the king walked into the room and he wasn't aware of who he was by appearance.
Yeah.
So he calls over this man who's just walked into the room and he says, "Can you just hold up my foot for me while I show this woman an X-ray demonstration?" And it turns out that that's the future king. So he's, like I said, ends up building his business. It's growing really well. And his devices end up extensively being used during the Boer War as well. He becomes a key supplier of apparatus for the War Office during that time. But like we've alluded to...
For field hospitals?
Yeah, so for field hospitals largely and the hospitals that they would erect during the war as well.
Right.
But it's during this time, particularly of extensive work, that he's working on a lot of different things, doing all this work for the War Office, experimenting quite a lot, that he starts to notice complications.
Yeah, right.
So then we have as early as 1898, which is very early on, he already is starting to notice the first signs of illness. So the illness is something called X-ray dermatitis, which results from the concentrated exposure to radiation.
Mm.
So this is a really nasty illness. It can cause things like skin abnormalities, swelling, cancers, ulcers and sores that just won't heal, and much, much more.
Yeah.
So the first signs for Cox, though, are his nails. They're seriously affected. So this is quite common for these early X-ray workers. Their nails would become brittle, peeling and all mangled.
Yeah.
So he notices this first and that he's also having complications with his eyes. A friend actually, in writing a report about these early signs in a number of X-ray workers, mentions Cox specifically and says that he's concerned that his friend might lose his eyesight.
Oh, right. Yes. Mm.
And this report is actually in 1901,
yeah.
So this is still quite early on. Sadly, the illness spreads and it gets even worse. Eventually, his hands, his arms, his face, throat, chin, chest are all impacted.
Mm.
He gets weaker, it causes him a lot of pain, and sadly, even the strongest opiates don't help at the time.
Yep.
So he undergoes several surgeries to try and stop the spread of the disease. Unfortunately, his right arm and a lot of his left hand have to be amputated.
Oh, goodness.
But these don't really help the condition.
Yeah.
So he works as long as he can, but eventually he's forced to retire at an early age.
Well, I guess while undergoing the treatment, but then going back to the factory and exposing himself yet again.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. For a time, it's reported that he did actually try to avoid X-rays to improve it. They thought this would help at the time.
Yeah.
But this, although they thought this was a cure, just avoiding it, it didn't.
Yeah.
It's not, sadly, not how it worked. So his family ends up in quite a bit of financial strain, and eventually he dies aged 46 on the 9th of July in 1910. So he's had this illness now for 12 years.
Oh, wow.
But it's his case and the progression of his illness being widely reported across the globe. You see this a lot in newspapers, even here in Australia.
Yep.
With an outpouring of support and empathy from the public, everybody starts talking about this case and cases like it. And people start to push for him to actually be granted a pension in recognition of his services as an X-ray pioneer and the work that he did for the war as well.
Yep.
But the government decides in 1909, so this late, that they will award him £200, but that he's not actually eligible for a pension.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So the public starts to raise money themselves, and all together with the donations that come in, they're sent to the newspapers, they're sent to a man on behalf of him. Eventually they raise a couple of £1,000.
Mm.
And that money is then given to his wife. He leaves behind a wife and three sons.
Yes.
So they are able to use that as their yearly annual pension moving forward.
Right. I'm assuming the company collapses after his death, or do they continue to operate?
You would think so, but the company actually continued to operate. So when he was forced to retire quite early on, he passes the company on to another man who purchases it. And without him, it doesn't do as well, sadly, but it does continue on for several years after that. And I think that's probably speaks to the devices that he himself created.
Yes.
But also that this was a huge market at the time. There's a lot of interest.
And growing and growing and growing,
exactly,
I imagine.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then particularly with World War I only a few years away.
That's right.
So again, a practical need for it.
Absolutely.
Just exponentially growing.
Absolutely. So it's growing really fast now, and we've seen after the things that he created for the war, how it can be used for the war effort as well.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think that kept his company alive. There's a really beautiful quote that ends up that he's supposedly reported to have said on his deathbed, which I just wanted to share. So despite everything that he goes through, Cox states, "I would gladly go through it all again to accomplish what I have been permitted to accomplish in perfecting this apparatus for the benefit of my fellow men."
So he's definitely thinking altruistic in that sense. That,
absolutely. You know, and I think this was kind of common. So the public very much felt that this was altruistic. What he did really was for the benefit of humankind, and others like him was for the benefit of humankind. And I think these early pioneers had this same thought as well. That's what drove them, and why he wanted to perfect this apparatus was for the benefit of humankind. Yes.
Now, obviously, we live in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. We've all had x-rays with broken bones and, mm-hmm. and other things, so that there's an awareness of the danger. There are safety protocols today. At what stage did x-rays become safe, quote-unquote, with lots of caveats?
Somewhat sadly, or ironically, I'm not sure, by the time that Cox actually passes away, they're already investigating safety measures. So because of cases like that of Cox and another man called Dr. Hall Edwards and others, scientists, manufacturers, and health professionals all start turning their attention to designing and implementing safety measures for people who are working with or being treated with x-rays.
Yep.
So by the time of Cox's death, x-ray operators are already using spectacles lined with lead alloy, gloves, apron, and masks made of rubber, which is mixed with lead, and lead-lined cabinets were being implemented in London Hospital. And the workers would stand behind those to avoid direct exposure themselves, because the rays couldn't actually pass through lead. Although, of course, we know that lead has certain dangers itself, yes. But in this case, it was much better than the way that they were exposing themselves without knowledge of the implications before.
I'm guessing demonstrations on general public at sideshow alleys and circuses and within the theatre is also declining by this stage.
Yes. So those sort of things wrap up quite a lot to an extent, and also become less common and are done differently for sure. Might have heard stories of, at one point, even in the 20th century, x-rays being done on people's foots to size them for shoes.
Yes,
that's how
yes.
ubiquitous it was. But we don't do that so much anymore.
Yes, thankfully.
Thankfully.
So in terms of the two that are in the collection, do we know if they were manufactured while he was alive or by the company after he'd passed away?
So there's two tubes that I've chosen. One is likely a little bit earlier than the other, and it's very possible that this one would have been made while he was alive.
Yep.
The other one shows some improvements to the design that are probably done either later on in his life, towards the end of his life, or afterwards.
Yeah.
But still in that early 1900s period. So just to kind of give you an explanation of how they actually work.
Yes, please.
Both of these tubes contain three electrodes, so a cathode, an anode, and an anti-cathode. When an electric current is supplied to the cathode, it accelerates something called electrons towards the target, or the anti-cathode in this case.
Yep.
And then when those really quickly moving electrons strike the target, 99% of the energy is converted into heat,
yep.
but less than 1% is converted into x-rays, and that's what the tube does. So in early tubes like these, we see both an anti-cathode and an anode, because it was believed that this helped the tubes to perform better, because people didn't quite fully understand how they worked or what made them work effectively. And we can see on one of the tubes, we have an anti-cathode that's really thin.
Yeah.
And then on the other one, we have an anti-cathode target that's really thick.
It's much, much thicker, isn't it?
Much thicker. And the anti-cathode on that thicker one is designed to be able to withstand the heat inside the tube. So otherwise, with this one that has the much thinner anti-cathode, they could melt from the heat inside the tube. The tube itself could crack from the heat, so this helps to withstand the heat. And it also has something that I mentioned earlier. It's an extra appendage coming out of the top, this more modern one.
Yep.
And that appendage is called a regulator. So this regulator is actually designed to release gas back into the tube, and that helps the tube to retain its function for a longer period.
Okay.
So that's kind of the two differences between these two tubes and how they function.
But it's also demonstrating an awareness of, you know, tinkering to improve as they're going along, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So we can see, yeah, we can see perhaps how using these sort of tubes has changed over time. And through using them, we've learned what does and doesn't work and what has to be adapted for them to work more effectively.
So how did they come to be in the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection? Have they come as a pair? Have they come to us separately? I'm assuming that they may have been used by the university for teaching, but do we even know?
So interestingly, they came separately.
Yeah.
And it was just through sort of looking at them and looking at their inscriptions
and seeing the name.
Yeah, and the name that we found that connection. But how they came into the collection, they've both come in through relationships with the university. So the older example has been in the collection for a long time, since the 70s. We don't know exactly where it came from, but it was definitely transferred from within the university, so probably from a department. Yep. Sadly, we don't know exactly how it would have been used. The other one, the more recent one, has come into the collection only a couple of years ago, actually, in 2021. And it was transferred to us, donated to us by a previous worker at the university who worked in radiology.
Oh, okay. Right. And presumably they were aware of the history of it in that case.
They were, and they donated a number of other instruments as well, X-ray instruments as well. They were particularly interested in the history of X-rays and radiology. So we were able to bring in quite a few things from him, speak about this sort of history and make those connections.
And do we know how that donor acquired them?
He acquired lots of these instruments over time, okay. So he was quite a collector.
Yeah,
he
so
was
during
personally,
his career.
Yeah, during his career, personally very interested in it, and that interest grew. So he was obviously keeping a lookout for these things, and when they stopped being used in departments, some of the other ones, he would collect those and have just built this collection over time.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My guest this episode is Kelsey McMorrow. So, Kelsey, have you found the way that you connect with these objects has changed over time as your research has progressed and as you've worked with them?
Yeah, I think mostly that's come from really working with lots of different objects in the collection over time. So you start to see how instruments all pair together in this bigger history of science and the contexts around them. And I think that's helped me to understand them a bit better. And the time that I've put into researching them has helped me understand them a bit better. And just developing those stories about them, I think, really helps you to connect with them. Empathetically as well.
Yeah. I mean, having that connection with the manufacturer is extraordinary because, again, we often tend to think, and again, a process of sort of industrialization of this idea of, oh, the company's just manufacturing it and now they pump the, the end of a factory. But in many ways, it's not just pioneering in terms of medical technology, but pioneering in terms of industrial design and industrial.
For sure.
Yeah, you know, the actual manufacturer is on the floor himself. And demonstrating.
I think it's really interesting. It's an interesting sort of history. It speaks to like that early craftsmanship and actually being more involved
hands-on
in the manufacturing process.
Now, the question that everyone who appears on the podcast gets asked, if you could choose one single word, any word in the English language, to describe your connection with the X-ray tubes, what word would you choose?
It's so hard to pick a single word. I think I'm going to say probably empathy.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pick that word because I think often, sort of like you said, when we look at objects, particularly scientific instruments, maybe they look cold or they don't look like they have these deeper stories and particularly personal stories behind them.
Yeah.
And I think these are great examples of how we can empathize with instrument makers and the histories behind these sort of objects.
Yes. Not to mention, you know, the range of uses for X-rays for us, from dentistry to medical to, you know, all sorts of applications that, you know, we don't even think about. But, of course, that process of trial and error that has enabled that to now be safe.
Yes.
Yeah. I know neither are currently on public display in the museum, but in future, if they are on display in an exhibition or we'll be able to view them in the collection search, what would you like visitors to the museum who get a chance to see the objects to think about when they're viewing them?
I think, like these and all other scientific instruments, it's a really good idea when you're looking at them to think about what are the broader stories behind them, what makes them interesting and important, and what about them is aesthetically beautiful as Because these are quite, I think, unusually, but aesthetically beautiful.
You're right, yeah. There's a real thought in terms of design, isn't there? That, yeah, they're stunning to look at.
They are. And it's just those stories behind them that I think people should think about. And if they don't know those stories, think about what stories might be behind them.
Mm-hmm. And think about how many people's lives have changed because of these machines.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
So it's not just glass and metal. It's flesh and blood as well.
Exactly. Beautifully put.
Put that on the banner. Kelsey, thank you. That's been a wonderful journey. And, you know, two objects that I must admit I probably wouldn't have stopped to look at. But now you've given me a whole new perspective, and I hope that our listeners, when they have an opportunity to see objects in our science collection and indeed other museum science collections, to think about them ever so differently. Thank you very much, Kelsey.
Thank you.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chow Chak Wing Museum wishes to pay our respects and acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands, sky and sea upon which we work.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.